all the bugs will show up pretty quickly, like once you let a kid try it.
This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
We're also very lucky to be joined by Amanda Rosler. Amanda is an iOS developer at Toca Boca, where she makes digital toys and games for kids. She's spoken about making games at conferences around the world, like One More Thing and OOL. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, guys.
So our topic today is making great games for kids, which is why Amanda is a great guest for us today, working at Toca Boca, which, if anyone has not heard of Toca Boca, they're basically the number one company in the world making mobile games, and definitely sort of these toy-like games for iOS and to some degree Android. So I want to start things off. Amanda, can you tell us a little bit about Toca Boca and how you guys do things?
Yeah, sure. So we're based in Stockholm in Sweden, and we make digital toys. That's what we call like the apps that we make, because they're not really games. They're more like toys. And yeah, I've worked there for 2.5 years, and it's a lot of fun.
So you've been working on the iOS games there, or I guess we should say toys. What would you kind of describe as, like, my understanding of when I think of games versus toys, as toys are like physical objects and games are like competitive. But obviously, if you've seen any Toca Boca games, like, they're obviously digital, they're games, or they would be in the games section of the App Store, but they're much more about sort of exploration and what we would classically think of as play, as opposed to think of like as trying to get a high score. Like, is there even any scores at all in Toca Boca games? Like, not
no, there isn't.
Kids.
Like in one of our apps, it's an older app called Robot Lab. You can collect stars, and you can get like 1, 2, or 3 stars, like depending on how good you are. But generally, we don't do that. Like, there are no rules, and like there's no way you can fail. Like, you can just play however you want to play with our apps, and yeah, there's no competition.
So is there like obviously it's a philosophy because it's what you guys do, but you know, do you know what the thinking behind leading to that was, or was it just something? Do you think that, I mean, you tried and it worked well?
Well, first of all, like, there are already like so many like regular games in the App Store, so we didn't really see the point in like making those type of games. Like, it's more like we wanted to give kids like some like really good tools to play with, because like you don't always have access to physical toys. Like, when you're in the car, for example, like you can't like play like and pretend that you're having like a tea party in the car. Like, you can't have like cups and silverware with you. So then you can use our app called Toca Tea Party and play with that instead. So it's,
I mean, it totally makes sense. And it's definitely from having seen my main exposure to Toca Boca games are actually through Nigel's kids. So I'm sure Nigel has like some thoughts. But it seems to me like instead of taking the place of time when they would be playing games, like, oh, okay, well, you can only play games for 30 minutes a day or whatever, because it's like just, you know, blowing up bad guys or whatever. It seems to instead take the place of pulling out, you know, building blocks or, you know, tea sets or things that you wouldn't normally tell your kids, okay, well, you can only play Tea Party for 30 minutes a day, you know, because it's play.
It also gives little kids a opportunity to be involved in video games in a way that they're not really like developmentally prepared for. I see that a lot with my youngest kid, who's 4, and she's a big gamer for a 4-year-old, but there's stuff that she just can't do. You know, she's just not able to play certain games, even though she really badly wants to, because she sees her older brothers playing them and wants to do all that stuff. So the Tokuboka stuff for her is great because it's something that there's nothing she has to worry about. She doesn't have to worry about doing anything in the right time or messing anything up or what her score is or any of like that. But she gets to do that same stuff that she sees the boys doing and that she wants to sort of be involved in. So in some ways, I think that the Tokuboka games are kind of training wheels for kids getting into video games as well. In addition to all the other stuff that they do in terms of, providing these like play opportunities and like Amanda said, providing the portability, like that's a huge one. We talked about this a couple episodes ago when we were talking about portable gaming consoles, but the difference of how long car rides go when you have stuff like this available to the kids versus before you did is just unbelievable, right?
The difficulty thing is interesting, actually, because having had sort of a normal gaming experience of the 80s going up through very difficult games, I used to think of, games that had a really, really easy, difficult level as kind of like a cop-out, like, oh, who would ever put it on very easy? And I thought that way until I tried to play, I think it was Band Hero, or Rock Band, I should say, Rock Band at Nigel's place a few years ago. And one of the kids, I don't remember if it was Sam or Jack, wanted to play along, but he was definitely not old enough to play any instrument at any level and not fail the whole band. And at that point, it's like, why not let the kid just have a difficulty level where it's just you kind of play along and some numbers appear, but you can just play, like not necessarily challenge, but play. And that kind of changed my thinking on that.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like that's such a good idea. And like we make apps that are like for kids as young as maybe 2 years old. And yeah, like you can't really do anything advanced when you're 2 years old. I mean, you can maybe drag stuff around on the screen and you think it's fun because you get some kind of feedback from it. But yeah.
You should tell the story, Nigel, of Katie and figuring out, I don't remember how old she was, but figuring out how to trigger a video on the iPad.
Yeah. So this is one of these like kids figuring out things that you don't think they ought to be able to figure out is, being being an iOS developer I quit my previous job and went into business with Alan, I guess when she was like 6 months old, something like that. So, basically I've sort of been, had iOS devices and stuff all over the place the whole time she's been growing up. So she's very used to them. They're kind of her main computing platform. And some of the stuff she was able to figure out in terms of how things behaved kind of blew me away. And the one that I was the most impressed with is she very quickly worked out like swiping around to look at apps and that there were certain apps that did things that she liked when she started them up. So she, one thing that she particularly liked is the intro to the iPad Monkey Island game. So this would have been, she was about 2 years old. So, definitely not at the point where she could do anything with it yet, but she figured out, like, she knows what this icon looks like. She taps it and she gets the little video of like the LucasArts logo coming up and the monkeys coming out and stuff like that. And she really liked that. But if she, if she hit the button and then she'd watch the video and she'd hit the home button and then she'd hit it again, wanting to see the video again, but of course the app had just been launched. And so it would go back into, go right back into like the main menu of the app. But what she worked out is she basically worked out the memory eviction policy that if she launched enough other apps, she'd get the intro video again. So what she would do is she'd launch the Monkey Island and she'd watch the video and then she'd go back to the home screen and then she'd go and launch like every other app and just immediately exit it. And then she'd launch the Monkey Island app again and watch the intro video.
So So you would think a two-year-old would not be able to deduce the memory eviction policy for iPad apps, but it turns out. So do you mentioned, age two is kind of like the minimum floor. For any given game, do you guys pick an age range? Like I've noticed on the App Store, they have specific ranges for kids. They have 0 to 5, 6 to 8, or 9 to 11, and you have to like pick one of those categories. When you're working on one of the games, is that part of the process, or is it sort of try to make it as broad as possible?
It's definitely part of the process. We don't always know like ahead of time like which age group it will be, but we usually decide beforehand, and then we'll sort of see if it's correct, because you never really know until you actually try it with kids.
And I imagine that's an interesting but maybe slightly scary process. You've built this game and it's mostly ready, and then you put it in the hands of some 6-year-olds and see how they react to it.
Yeah, definitely. All the bugs and interaction problems like show up immediately, because kids like use an iPad in or an iPhone in such a different way, like from that I do. Like for example, when pinching, like using the pinch gesture, like instead of doing it like in a smooth and controlled way, like you and I would do, like they just like pinch like crazy, like makes really like small, short pinches, because that is more natural to them, I guess.
And they have tiny hands too.
Yeah. So like all the bugs will show up like pretty quickly, like once you let a kid try it.
I had a couple times where one of our apps I used to work on a long time ago, you could actually give it to one of the employees' kids, who was maybe like 3 or 4 at the time, and would just tap randomly. It was a business app, like had nothing to do with kids. But like, the random tapping of this child would always produce bugs, because this was on Palm OS. It was hard to deal with. It wasn't very well evented. So if one thing was in the middle of happening and then you had the system do another thing, or an event came in, the event would get dropped, or you'd have some null pointer or things like that. So you definitely like would come across bugs that no normal human would trigger in their normal usage of it, but sometimes accidentally trigger by like accidentally double tapping when they meant to single tap or something. But the kids would just go tap, 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 and like tap. And if something didn't load, they would tap again like a quarter of a second later.
I'm constantly explaining that to my kids. Like just saying it doesn't matter if you tap it again, nothing's going to change. You know,
if you're waiting,
they're sort of convinced that if something doesn't respond immediately, the correct approach is just to start tapping or start clicking the mouse button or start hitting the keys. And it's like, no, at best, that's going to be a neutral operation, and quite possibly it's going to make things worse.
Right.
And I think that's part of just like growing up with the iOS devices, which have this real focus on responsiveness. You know, that the older two kids are using like the Macs a lot more because they want to play Minecraft, and Minecraft on the iPad is not up to their, you know, their standards in terms of how many mods they can cram in and stuff. So they've got to use the Mac for stuff, but you know, it's got like it's a like slightly underpowered Mac Mini, and it's got an old spinning Rust hard drive instead of an SSD, and like it's just slow at some stuff. So, you know, sometimes I just have to say, calm down, like let the icon bounce. Clicking the icon more times is not going to get this thing to load faster, you know?
That's something that they never ever would have learned if they grew up on DOS, where if you keep on typing when one thing is waiting, then you just, all the things that you typed will just end up happening in sequence after the thing that was blocked unblocks. So you learn very quickly as a kid on those older computers to not do that. But that definitely brings up like something I think is interesting in designing games for kids, which is that I've sort of observed, is that kids will find any dead end. Like, especially the younger kids, like 0 to 5, if there's any way that you can get the app into a state where you're no longer, like, you can, like, end up leaving the app, let's say, like, something you can click on, which is, like, click here to see our frequently asked questions, but then that loads some website, then they can easily just not be able to get back to the app again. And then the parents dealing with the kids upset, and then you don't know why. And you're like, I don't know, where are you? You know, maybe one parent sets up the game and says, oh, play this. And then they end up hitting the FAQs. And then they go to the second parent and they're like, ah, it's broken. And they're like, what's broken? What? I don't know. You're in the FAQs for some game. I don't know how to get back to the game. So it's definitely, I imagine that comes up in playtesting.
Yeah, definitely. But we don't have a lot of links that lead outside. We have one link that is to like the information that is for parents, but that still loads inside the app, and there is like a back arrow that you can press.
So there's always a way to get back into what the kids want.
Yeah, there is.
I've actually seen a couple apps for kids, and I'm not sure if the Tokuboku games do this, where in order to get to certain functions that the kids probably don't care about, you have to do something unusual, like a three-finger tap in order to get to some extra menus or settings and things like that.
That is actually a requirement now in the kids category on the App Store, that you need to have like something like that to stop kids from getting like outside the app. And we do have that, because we have ads for our own apps inside the apps, and if you like, if you tap on one of those, you get like a pop up where you have to enter your age.
Ah, so if you can't enter if you're two, you will not be able to successfully enter your age, and you will not know that you can't put two, even if you can. So.
Yeah, actually, it's the year you were born, not your age. But yeah,
right,
exactly.
Yeah, and that's actually, so reading a little bit about and having seen the Tokuboku games, there's some specific rules that you always follow. One is no ads except for your own games, and even then it's not like a banner ad like Punch the Monkey thing. It's just sort of a tasteful, here are other games you might like, which they legitimately probably would like if they're using Tokuboku game. So no ads, which is obviously a huge thing. And then the other is no in-app purchase. Which to me is just, I mean, I don't like in-app purchase anyway, but the number of horror stories I've heard of kids accidentally racking up $500 in in-app purchases that they didn't realize they were making, or maybe they realized, but their parents didn't realize, is one thing. But the thing that really kind of gets under my skin is games that are built to really hook kids and then try to extract in-app purchases by upsetting them, basically. Like, this you know, baby pig that you've now raised needs some feed, otherwise it's going to die, unless you make this in-app purchase for more feed. And that's, like, actually immoral.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, it's just wrong to take advantage of kids like that. I mean, yeah.
But it's profitable if the parents will let the kids download those games, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, sure. But I mean, it's not worth it, in my opinion. So
it does seem to me like Apple has cracked down on that to some degree, like not working in that area of the App Store. I'm not familiar if there are extra restrictions or extra stuff you need to jump through there. But looking at the stuff that's, at the stuff in the top grossing, which is usually where the sleaze hides in the other app store categories, there is lots of stuff there that, that's free with in-app purchase, but the in-app purchases seem way less exploitive. Like, you don't have the container of monetary units phenomenon that goes on in the regular games charts, where it's just all these consumable in-app purchases. Like, looking at the top grossing kids app, which I just brought up right now, it seems to be mostly either stuff where it's like, okay, yeah, Club Penguin, you need to get a subscription for it, but it's like you pay X amount of money per year and that's it. And there's these ones that are like, okay, they're video things that you're getting subscriptions to. Like, there's the Treehouse app is up there, and Strawberry Shortcake Bake Shop. Well, there's a bunch of stuff you can buy for it, but it seems to be all stuff of the form, once you've bought it once, you've got it. So it feels like there has to be someone at Apple that's on the case there and stopping that stuff from making it into the kids' app store.
Are consumables even allowed in kids' apps? Like, I'm looking through these, and, well, I mean, the number one and number two paid apps on the kids' app store that I'm seeing are both Tokoboka games, which is great.
Well, but like I said, the top grossing is where it is what you got to look at to spot right. the free within app purchase, right? And right. Toka Hair Salon, I think, is... Oh, not sure. There's one more. Looks like there's one more non-free one in the top grossing. But it is mostly free stuff with in-app purchase, but it's less scungy in-app purchases than in the rest of the games categories. That's for sure.
Do you know if that's allowed, Amanda, consumables? I know you're not really in the business of in-app purchase.
But. Yeah. No, I don't know. But I can imagine that even if it is allowed, like that they probably wouldn't feature an app that had that.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's true. But the fact that like the top 10 top grossing kids apps, none of them have consumables. And if you look at the top grossing non-kids apps, all of them have consumables. My guess is that I haven't seen that in any of the rules, but my guess is that they're sort of cracking down on that. Mm-hmm. Either they're just completely banning it, or they have such strict rules for them that they're not as prolific.
Yeah.
So on iOS 8, and this is something that you'd mentioned in the sort of chat we have here, that there's this new feature that you can ask a parent for permission for buying. So anyone who hasn't seen the WWDC announcements, this is basically instead of what there is right now when a kid tries to make an in-app purchase, that it just comes up with the password for the parent. You can actually have it come up and say, ask your parent, like press this to ask your parent about this, and then it'll actually be a push notification will appear on the parent's device that says, Timmy wants to buy a bucket of, you know, whatever, or you want to buy some feature in this app. Do you want to approve it or deny it? It costs this amount of money. Do you think that feature would make you sort of more warm to the idea of having in-app purchases for apps for kids? Or is it just kind of like a Band-Aid on something that's just not worth exploring?
Like, I definitely think it makes it better, but I still don't think that we will have any in-app purchases. But yeah, I think, as long as the parents don't turn off that feature, because I'm guessing that they will be able to do that.
Sure.
Then I think it is more okay, I think, because at least kids like can't buy stuff accidentally. I think it's slightly better.
But I think it would be, I mean, I'm sure you're right in that at this point, Tokoboka has made such a name for, you've made such a name for yourselves not having an app purchase, that having one game that had one app purchase would just be not worth it, because everyone would suddenly, it would be tainted to the brand, you know? Mm-hmm. And people being able to trust the apps is something that has such a long-term benefit that it's worthwhile.
Yeah.
I was kind of reading a little bit, and the most recent game that you worked on is Toka Town, I understand it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Toka Town is like, it's a 2D game. It's basically like, it's a like a digital dollhouse. You have like a bunch of characters from our other apps, and there are, I think, six locations, like there is an apartment, a restaurant, a store, a park, and then you just like you drag the characters around and you play with them like as if they were dolls, basically. Like the characters can't walk by themselves, you just have to drag them with your finger and pretend that they are walking, and then yeah, you just like make stuff up, like take two characters, put them in a room, pretend that they are hanging out or going to the store or whatever.
I love that. You just make stuff up. It's
yeah,
something that sounds so simple, but it's kind of actually not that common. And, you know, kids, more and more the games are becoming realistic, or even toys themselves are becoming more realistic. It's not just like a Lego cube anymore. It's a fully formed car or whatever. So I love that.
My research for this show was spending about half an hour playing Toka Town with my daughter before she had her bath tonight. And And yeah, it was all about like the stories that she had about all the characters. It, you know, the I asked her to like show me the game and tell me what was going on in the game. And even the other Toka games, like a lot of times when she showed me something, it would be like, oh, here's something I can do. Like if you, you know, if you get this thing out of the food, out of the fridge, you can, you know, you pick the knife, you can chop it up, and then you can put it in the blender, like describing the sort of mechanics of things to me. But with Toka Town, it was all about, oh, well, here's what's going on. Like the bad guys have been put in jail right now, and tonight the bad guys are going to break out, and they're going to go rob the store.
Tonight, Robin Hood and his buddy are going to sneak in to the thing when it's bedtime.
But that's not something that the game has decided. That's something that she's decided on her own.
Yeah, that's something that she... I mean, you know, some of that, I think, is sort of set up in that there is a jail and there is this character who sort of, you know, it seems to be a criminal in some sense. Like, he's got a kind of shifty look to him. But I don't think it's... I don't think there's any... I don't think there's any specific thing there in the design of the game that encourages kids to do that. She just sort of worked out like, hey, there's a jail. Hey, there's this guy who kind of looks like he might be a crook. And so she started, you know, making up a story about that.
It wasn't until I saw your talk at Ool, Amanda, that I realized that the characters in the Toka Boca games, actually, there's some sort of persistence in between them, that the characters appear in multiple games and things like that. Is there any particular thinking that goes into that, or particular hero characters that the kids become really attached to, or is it just kind of, yeah, maybe we'll pick this one from here or maybe this one from there? Do they have names or anything? Like, I'm not really up to date on the state of the Toka world.
Right. They do have names, but like only outside the apps. Like, they're never actually like said in the apps. It's just like we have names for them so that we can refer to them like at work.
Right.
But we usually create new characters for each game. Like, we have a few characters that show up in several games. Like the T-Bot is one character. He's in several games. So actually, Toka Town is the first app where we have reused like so many characters from our older apps. And like, we thought that kids would like that, but it turns out like that they didn't actually care as much about that. Yeah. Like, they recognized some of the characters, but it didn't really make much of a difference for them. Actually, like, the most popular characters are the two babies, and they are completely new. Yeah,
that's interesting. Because when I see, like, the kids, Nintendo is the other brand that I really think of when I'm thinking about kids' games and watching kids interact with games. And the repeating of Mario in so many games, or Toad or Princess or whatever, that they see in the Nintendo games seems to be a big deal to Nigel's kids, at least. So it's interesting that in the Toka world, I guess maybe because it's more of a toy than a competitive thing, maybe that influences their perspective on that.
I don't know, like, or maybe it's just because we haven't like reused them before, so they have only seen the characters in one app instead of like the same character in every app, like Nintendo, like with Mario, who's in every game.
Yeah, and also not given it a name, and it not made any one character necessarily the hero, mm-hmm. other than maybe the character that appears on the icon. Like, I recognize the girl on the Toka Hair Salon icon because I've seen her, you know, enough times from the top charts and things like that.
Some might also be just not having a story, you know, that the fact that the stories are the ones that they make up rather than ones that are imposed on them by the narrative of the game means that different characters are going to be important to them in different ways. Whereas when you're dealing with characters from a franchise like Mario, you know, things are set up. Like, you know who these guys are. There's this continuity of character in Mario and Luigi and the princess, and, you know, across multiple games, and they all have the same voice, and it becomes something where they're recognizable. Whereas I think that, you know, the stuff in Tokuboka games is more like a physical toy, that what's important is what the kid attaches to it in the story they're telling, and that doesn't necessarily translate to the next game.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing that I think of when I think about the characters in the games is, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you were talking about at UL, Amanda, about the sort of design of the sort of characters to try and balance the game so that both boys and girls would be interested in the games? Because I thought that was super eye-opening to me. It's something that sounds really obvious when you mention it. Like, if you just make the one game that's all about Disney princesses and every character wears a dress and looks exactly the same, then, you know, it's only going to be interesting to a subset of kids potentially, as opposed to if you just say, okay, well, you can have princesses and you know, boys and girls and monsters that have no particular gender. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I guess one of our philosophies is that we want to make apps that for all kids, not for a specific gender. So we have thought a lot about that when making our apps, and we try to have as many male as female characters, and also some animal characters that you don't really know which gender they are. It's a problem with toys, I think, because there's a segregation between the toys for girls and the toys for boys, and I don't think there should be a difference. All toys should just be for all kids.
I've been reading a bit and paying more attention to this since then, whenever there's an article or whatever, and apparently there was, through the 70s, more unification. When Lego first came out, it was fairly well balanced in between boys and girls. And now there's the blue section of Lego with all of the construction kits and vampires. And then there's the pink section of Lego with the dolls and the dresses and the princesses. And that's obviously Lego could express anything. And there's no particular reason to make it gendered other than maybe the Lego company hopes that they're going to sell twice as many. You know, if a family has a boy and a girl, then maybe they'll sell two sets of Lego instead of one that the kids share and hand down, maybe. Presumably that's part of the motivation. It's definitely, I'd much rather see twice as much Lego and have everyone share it. It's kind of a no-brainer, right?
Yeah. It makes no sense that some Lego should be only for girls. I mean, Lego is Lego, and you just build stuff with it. And also, if girls and boys want to play together, it doesn't make sense to have, toys that are specific for boys and for girls, because then they won't be able to play together with those toys.
Yeah, well, they will theoretically be able to, but then at any given time, they're thinking, oh, well, I'm playing with Barbies right now, and that's a girl's toy. Just wait until we can play with my toys, because, you know, it delineates that split in between boys and girls in a way that's totally artificial, and there's no point to it other than just, further underlining that gender perception that obviously is not even, to any degree relevant in how kids play with toys. So
it's also something that if you've got mixed gender and mixed age kids like I do, that it's nice to have things that, you know, that the boys don't feel weird about playing with Katie with, you know, that they're older and they've got their own games and stuff like that, but they will, you know, they will kind of play with her if it's something that interests them enough, but there's got to be a certain gender neutrality to it. They're not gonna want to play with her if she's playing some Disney princess game to the same degree that they are if it's something that's more gender neutral and that spreads across age ranges better. So it's nice to have those, you know, it's nice to have those non-gendered toys, even in cases where the kids do like toys that are more gender specific, because it gives them, you know, it gives them a point of reference. It gives them a way for boys and girls to play together and be able to agree on something to play with.
Yeah. Plus you get twice as many toys that the kids can share. Right. So kind of a no-brainer. Another thing that I thought was interesting sort of on the topic of games for kids is this idea of educational games. When I think back to the games I played when I was a kid, they were all, the computer games specifically, they were all very specifically educational, like companies like Broderbund and these that were making, and I guess it was like MaxOffer at the time, that is to teach kids a specific lesson, more or less, whether that's number crunchers to teach you your adding and your subtracting and your multiplication, or something like Oregon Trail to try to teach you like history or geography. Although mostly I just learned that you can only carry so much meat before you spoils and you can't bring it back on your wagon. But
and that you really don't want to catch dysentery.
No, dysentery is bad. You definitely don't want that. And I still remember that to this day. So I guess it was successful. But when I see games for kids now, and maybe that's just the fact that I'm not spending any time in elementary schools, instead I'm seeing what people are doing sort of in real life, but also looking at, you know, the App Store charts and the games that people are talking about, they don't seem explicitly educational to the same degree or even nearly as much. Do you think that that's a reflection of what kids get interested in playing, or do you think that's just like an evolution of sort of realizing that it can be okay for kids to be spending time on a computer when they're not doing some obvious educational activity?
Yeah, maybe, but I think there's still quite a lot of educational games, actually. Like just looking at the chart, like the top charts, there's like one where you, I don't know, count fruits and stuff like that. I still think like a lot of parents think that if their kids are going to play a game, then it should be educational in some way also, because just playing games isn't good enough. But I don't know, like obviously there are also a lot of just plain games that are not educational.
Just looking through the top charts, one of the games that's on that very verge of like people claim it's educational, but it's of questionable educational value is the ever famous memory flip, like matching game. Like, oh, you flip this thing. Oh, you found a heart. Oh, hey, this one is also a heart, and you have to, you know, match two. I know there's a name for that game, but like, there was often games like that when I was a kid, and supposedly they're educational, but I never exactly knew what the educational goal was other than I can match two hearts.
Well, I mean, our apps are also in the education category, even though they are not actually very educational.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's mostly like just a marketing strategy, I guess. Because like we can't put them in the games category because there's so much stuff there. So we put them in education because also that's where parents look, I think. Like now we have the kids category, but before that, there was just games and education and maybe entertainment to choose between. So we put them in education.
Well, if you think of what fills a kindergarten classroom, it's sort of the analog versions of a lot of what you would find in a Tokoboka game anyway, like, you know, building blocks and dollhouses and tea sets and things like that. And, you know, to the degree that you're learning things in kindergarten, you're learning things when you're playing a Tokoboka game, I would say.
Yeah, sure.
Another thing that I think might be going on there is that there's a lot more of that stuff going on as part of the regular educational curriculum now. Like, you know, my kids, the older two ones, get bits of homework that are like doing various educational, gamey kind of things on various online sites. And, you know, they do stuff like that in school. And our kids' school doesn't even have like a super heavy duty, like IT program. You know, they don't have enough computers that there's like a computer lab that the kids can go to and all sit down and every kid have a computer kind of thing. But there are some schools that do and that actually have regular, you know, regular classes that involve that sort of stuff. And I think that might work to segment the market along a different line than it did when that stuff wasn't, you know, wasn't trusted as much before, that now if the kids are doing things that are sort of educational games as part of school, they're not going to be as willing to accept something like that in a time that they're supposed to be having fun, right? And computers are just more ubiquitous. Like, they know more about how computers work and what kind of stuff is on them, and you can't put things over on them as easily as you could, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, that they're going to, you know, they're going to realize that there's stuff out there that's just fun as opposed to stuff that's trying to teach them something. And they're going to gravitate to that, it, you know, because they want to play. Like you said, that's, you know, at that age, that kind of imaginative play and exploration and stuff like that is a big part of how you learn things. And so, you know, then that's not some feature of the games industry or anything. That's kind of a universal, like, you know, your brain at that age has to be curious about things to form all of the neurological connections for stuff that you're going to need later on. And so it's, you know, kids are drawn towards that kind of stuff.
And it's great. Watching kids play is really fun, actually. I think that's an awesome coverage of our topic. We've covered the ins and outs of making games for kids and what's good and what's bad. So thanks a lot for coming on the show, Amanda. Thanks to listening for everybody out there. We always want to know what you think. So please give us some feedback either by email, hello@upup.fm, or on the iTunes store. See you next week. Something that's like on topic, like a quarter away on topic, because kids love Minecraft, but also like in the gaming news, is this thing where Minecraft is like trying to ban servers. Have you guys seen this?
Oh, yes. I've been watching that closely servers. Because my Jack particularly is on me constantly to get him some of this stuff. I have signed them up for like one server that they were playing on all the time that, you know, you could get like a lifetime membership for the server and get a bunch of extra perks for an amount of money that wasn't totally unreasonable. And yeah, I've been keeping an eye on things as they evolve, but it's definitely a pretty scammy kind of area, like even more so than in-app purchase, because in addition to the regular scamminess of that kind of purchasing stuff, you also have, like, you know, type your credit card number into some random, like, Minecraft server kind of stuff going on. That's
So to anyone who hasn't heard or does not follow Minecraft very closely, the rules have always been officially that you can't charge for like anything that's pay to win or like items that advantage you in a Minecraft server, if you're going to go off and run your own Minecraft instance. But this has never been very well enforced, and now the folks that make Minecraft, Mojang, are trying to crack down on this. And I don't know if the kids necessarily will care as much if that goes away, because probably the fact that parents won't let them have their credit card number entered into some random Minecraft server to get the Sword of Truth or something like that is probably more frustrating to them than anything. But the people who run these services are whining about it. While you're not busy making games, Amanda, have you had a chance to play any recently?
Like right now I'm playing Dead Space 3.
How's that?
It's pretty fun. Like I'm playing it in co-op, which makes it more fun, I think. And I'm also playing through like all the Metal Gear Solid games because I haven't played them before. So I've played 1, 2, and 3, and now I'm playing Peace Walker.
Do they stand up to the test of time?
Like well, like you sort of have to get used to the controls, I guess, and like the story, like is very
weird.
I don't know. Yeah, it's very weird, and like all the female characters are like they need to be saved.
Of course.
Yeah, but I guess that's the same in modern games as well. So, but yeah. But yeah, I think like the first one and the third one were pretty fun to play.
We were talking actually just on the last episode that the third one's storyline, actually I haven't played the first one, but the third one's storyline, the one I played all the way through, just got into really weird, like bizarre, on the border of like, are they serious about this? Or is this kind of an inside joke? Or I don't really understand exactly what's going on. But probably I would have benefited more if I'd played them one after another like you have, so that they're referring back to the previous games in a way that would actually make sense.
Yeah, well, they still don't make a lot of sense, I think. but I think like the second one is the worst. Like, you think you understand the story, but then at the end, like, everything changes and you don't understand anything. And it's just weird in general.
Okay, well, I feel a little bit better then. I didn't understand it.
Right.
I don't know much about Dead Space other than it's a like kind of a horror survival sort of thing in space.
Yeah.
Is it more of like an RPG kind of thing or a BioShock kind of thing, or is it just a kind of straight up shooter, or what's the gist?
No, it's a shooter, and but. Like, the thing in the third game is that you can sort of, like, craft your own weapons. Like, you combine different parts and make new weapons.
Co-op is something that interests me, and I haven't done as many. Like, I really enjoy it when I do, especially if I can get an audio connection and on the PS3, that's a questionable endeavor, but I expect on the PS4 it's going to be better, and on PC, obviously, Skype or whatever makes it pretty easy. But when I have played co-op, whether it's Left 4 Dead or any of these other, any game with dead in the title, I guess, it's a lot of fun. Obviously, it's only as fun as the people you're playing with, but... yeah, it's something that I think that I got to spend a little bit more time and effort. It takes some coordination, obviously, to get other people who haven't played the game yet and make sure that they bought it on the same platform as you and that you have the right time that you've scheduled to play it. Unless, I guess you can probably play co-op with randoms on the internet, but that's not quite the same.
I don't know if you were there when Jeremy and I were talking about it at work, but there's a lot of interesting looking co-op stuff coming out of this year's E3.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's several games. Like, there's the co-op stuff in Assassin's Creed. There's a new Rainbow Six game that's focused around like head-to-head co-op. There's The Division, which is like a RPG shooter kind of thing that has some co-op elements, and it looks like maybe even has some like second screen stuff in it that you can have like people that are playing on iPads join the game in some way as well, or something like that. And yeah, there's it looks like there's gonna be some pretty cool stuff coming out for like PS4, Xbox One the next year or so with a co-op focus.
I guess the Tokuboka games are all kind of co-op because most of them allow you to sort of touch the screen arbitrarily. It's a lot easier to play together than it is with something that requires an internet connection and two people on different sides of their TVs with a voice chat all synced up or whatever. You just like on an iPad, I guess, more than the phone, and the phone is kind of cramped. But
we definitely think about that when we make our games. Like, for example, Toka Store, and then you're supposed to be two players, like one shopkeeper and one customer. And also in Toka Tea Party, you can be as many as you want.
Wait a minute. So I want to dig into this a little bit. So you have a Toka store where there's a shopkeeper and a person who's buying it, but it's not competitive. Is it not competitive then? Like, are they trying to barter? Like, can some one person like get a really good deal and then the other person is upset? Or is it... How does it work?
I wouldn't say that it's competitive. But yeah, like the shopkeeper sets a price and the other person pays. But if you run out of money, you get more money.
So, oh, okay.
Like,
so the kids won't be that upset if they get a bad deal.
And something like Tea Party is definitely, it's almost intended for multiple players. Like that's one that Katie, I don't think, even plays much by herself. And she hasn't been playing a lot recently because since she's got Toka Town, that's kind of all she's cared about. But back when she first got it, she was pretty heavily into it. And I don't even think she'd play it much by herself. She always wanted someone to play with her whenever she played Tea Party. Whereas most of the other ones, like Toka Band and Hair Salon and stuff like that, she'll happily play those by herself. But Tea Party, she wants someone there. Like, it's all about having the other person and, like, asking them what stuff they want to drink and pouring it and then getting them to drink it and all that stuff.
But isn't that the most classic thing? Like, it's so perfect that, like, I guess the game has perfectly captured what kids have done for tea parties for 100 years, except that they used to just do it with their parents' tea and silver or teacups and silverware, and then they did it with plastic teacups and silverware, and now they're doing it on the iPad. But there's some sort of ingrained instinct for children to serve tea to other people. You know, you visit a kid's. I remember doing that when I was like a teenager. I can't remember off the top of my head whose kids it was, but it's like, oh, you have to come to the tea party. And it's like, you have to sit there and you sip your imaginary tea and a teddy bear is at one of the other seats. And that's just what you do. You know, it's ingrained into our DNA.
And another interesting co-op experience that I just had is Sam and I have been playing through Mario Kart 8 the last little while. And it almost has co-op as well, in a sense, in terms of finishing the single player game and unlocking everything, because unlike the previous games, the like multiplayer games count towards the unlocking progression. So you can start up the like Grand Prix in multiplayer mode, and if either of the players gets the gold ranking or gets the star ranking or whatever, you'll unlock whatever it is that, you know, that you unlock for finishing that. So you can actually kind of co-op the game, you know, even though technically speaking, you're racing against each other. Sam and I burned through that way faster than we had doing the same thing with Mario Kart Wii, because with Mario Kart Wii, it was always like, all right, we got to start in single player and, you know, Sam will do this cup because he really likes this cup, but there's this one on this other cup that he has trouble with, and so he's got to trade off to me for that one, and if one of us screws up, then we got to start the whole thing over. Whereas as playing the game both at the same time gave us like two parallel chances to unlock the stuff, and we got to play together as opposed to one person sitting and watching the other person play.
So I haven't played Mario Kart 8 yet. I hear it's great. But I have to ask, is this thing about Luigi's death stare actually, is it something you would notice on the game, or are people just making a big deal out of it, that he's, like, staring you down when he drives by?
I hadn't noticed it until I started seeing those things. And I don't really watch the replays much, but I have now seen it a couple of times. I think it's just sort of like he's got a slightly strange facial expression and will, you know, does sort of look like he's looking at you. But yeah, I mean, once you've seen the animations, you can sort of notice it in game sometimes.
Right. Okay. So it's not entirely like one time thing that it's something you might actually notice in the game.
Yeah.
Do you have a Wii U, Amanda?
Yeah. Yeah. I have also been playing Mario Kart 8. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I would feel like kind of not giving up. Like, I feel like I was so negative about the Wii U, like when it hit its very bottom, which was basically 2 weeks ago when we recorded the episode, that it was dead. And then now not only has the Mario Kart game come out, which is selling it's a reasonable number of Wii U's, but also they announced some interesting looking games that are not, like, everyone says, oh, they need another 3D Mario game. They need another traditional Zelda game, and they're working on that stuff, but kind of sort of new takes on some of that stuff as well. The Hyrule Warriors, I think it was called, and things like that. So I'm now curious and interested in that anyway, even if I'm not going to run out and buy one quite yet.
Mario Maker is the other one that
Your kids would love that.
My kids are pretty excited about, yeah.
Well, didn't your kids like spend 2 years making Mario levels on paper?
Yeah, Jack was big into like drawing out Mario levels. He's actually less excited about Mario Maker than Sam is because he's so into Minecraft and that scratches that itch for him. But Sam's a bit flightier that way than Jack is. Like, he's not just all Minecraft all the time. So, yeah, but they're really looking forward to that. We had like a big, after all the videos were released, we had like a big trailer watching like family afternoon where we sat down. I showed them all the trailers for all the games that I thought they were going to like. And yeah, they were super excited about Mario Maker.
Yeah. I think like there was one game, called Splatoon, I think, which is like a multiplayer game where you shoot paint at each other.
Oh, I didn't see that one. That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's like, it's different because there are completely new characters. Like, it's not Mario like it always is. But it seems like it could be fun.
Yeah, it's a first-party Nintendo game, too, I think. It's, like, published by Nintendo, I believe. But it's taking the first-person shooter genre, which is obviously a fun genre, but doing the Plants vs. Zombies garden warfare thing where, hey, it turns out you could have the mechanics of firing objects at the other players without it needing to be soldiers with blood and guts and explosions. And, well, you can have paint explosions.
Oh, yeah, this looks really cool. I don't know how I missed this one, but, yeah, this looks awesome. Yeah, it's, I mean, I think I mentioned that before in regards to Garden Warfare, but it really, it's kind of lame that there haven't been more games like that because, I mean, kids of, like, my two older kids aged 8 and 10 are so into the idea of, like, shooting and fighting games. And, you know, they're just not quite at that age where you can just be like, all right, here's a copy of Call of Duty, go nuts. But, you know, something like Garden Warfare or something like this is perfect because it's something that gives them what they want without making me feel like a terrible parent for letting them play games that are just letting them like splatter people's brains all over the wall.
Splatoon actually has an interesting game mechanic that I have never seen before, where your character is actually, and I guess maybe that I've seen sort of variations of this with like sort of capture the flag things, but your characters actually paint the ground or can paint the ground using their weapons or whatever. And then the areas that they painted are their territory and they can like run faster in there where they painted. And I believe there are certain circumstances where they can warp to other places that they painted. And then your opponents try to paint over places that you painted, which is kind of a classic sort of, it has the feeling of King of the Hill or Capture the Flag or sort of like territorial area. Capture the Flag is actually not the right example. King of the Hill, sort of capture the area gameplay in other shooting games, except the fact that it doesn't need to be realistic. Like, you couldn't really do this exact gameplay in anything that was trying to look like a military shooter because, like, you're putting giant, like, this character has a paint roller that's maybe, like, 5 times wider than she is as she's running along. It just doesn't make any sense. But it looks like it could be a pretty fun mechanic. The other interesting shooter that I saw, I think it came out of, maybe it wasn't at E3, but it's coming in at the same time, was this one, Super Hot, which is the shooter where time only moves when you move. You guys see this?
I heard about it, but I didn't watch the trailer for it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either.
It's basically, like, it is what it is. Like, they just have a demo for a Kickstarter, which is, actually, I think it started as, like, a game jam, as many of these things do. But it was, it's a first-person shooter. Time only moves when you move, and so it becomes much more strategic and tactical. Like, all right, you're going to aim, and you're going to do this, and then you're going to dodge a bullet, and then you're going to do this, and then you're going to duck, and you're going to move through. And so, like, their style has no storyline. It has, the characters are just, like, sort of models that don't have any textures on them, basically, but it's sort of exploring that game mechanic, which I always think is interesting how, because we already have these game engines that are really well suited to doing first-person shooter, we end up with things like Portal and Superhot, where people are like, all right, what if we just tweak this first-person shooter formula and do something totally different, because we already get 90% of the first-person shooter for free, so what other things have no one done yet? It's kind of cool.